What's up, guys? You're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We record episodes and interview the very best experts from around the world and cover topics relating to health, success, mindset, business, and even social issues. And each week, we give you some of the best advice and information on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. Your elite life begins now. On today's episode, episode number 325, entitled, How to Enhance Your Immune System and Protect Your Loved Ones from Sickness, I chat with Steve Fowkes. Steve Fowkes is an organic chemist, neurobiochemist, brain function and metabolism expert, and the creator of Project Wellbeing. In today's episode, Steve talks about all the tools necessary for keeping yourself and your family healthy in today's chaotic world. He dives into nutritional deficiencies, high-dose vitamin therapy, ozone therapy, nebulizing hydrogen peroxide, and understanding and overcoming the many dangerous pathogens in our everyday life, and so much more. If you're wondering what you need to do today to keep you and your loved ones safe and healthy, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from Elite Man Magazine. And my guest today is my friend, Steve Fowkes, who is a returning guest. I think we did a couple episodes, actually, Steve, a couple years ago. So it's good to have you back on, man.
It's good to be here.
And what's your main website, actually? I forget the name of the site.
Project Wellbeing.
That's right.
Is one. And CERI, CERI.com, is an older one that deals with smart drugs and treatments for Alzheimer's and Down syndrome and Parkinson's disease.
Gotcha. Yeah, and you're basically like considered the godfather of biohacking. You've been around, one of the founders, really, of this whole movement, and you know, done incredible things for so many years, and really inspired me to do a lot of things in my own life and helped me out. So I appreciate that, man. And it's been incredible, especially the last year or so with what's going on in the world. All the things that you've been doing for the past, you know, 30, 40 years of your life have really kind of come full circle into what's going on, because so many people, as we talked about a couple of minutes ago, are unaware of, say, nutritional deficiencies or, you know, background viral loads in their body or different problems that functional medicine experts or biohackers have been talking about and implementing into their own lives for many years. Now it's like, all right, we got to go back to what you guys have been talking about for so many years, because, you know, with COVID, with all these things happening, it really
getting real.
Yeah, it gets real. And they're actually faced with even their own death in so many ways, like mortality is, they're coming face to face with it. So it's become ever more important today than, you know, than it ever has been before. And so it's good to bring you back on to talk about what's going on in 2021, what's happened in the past year. I want to break down what your thoughts on of the treatments for COVID, what they're doing, what conventional medicine's doing, and also what you recommend people do as well. But can we just first start with what have you been up to in your own life in the past year or two, since I think last we talked, probably 2 years ago?
Well, the big change was last year when COVID hit and all this publicity started up. It was kind of like a bad movie experience, you know, watching this from the sidelines. And, because of the knowledge that I have, the fear tactics never got me. I was never plugged in by it. I could see their lips moving, in other words. And part of my comfort with this kind of issue is, you know, being knowledgeable about the mechanisms of immune function, for example, and how the immune system functions in layers. And I had spent 40 years researching the role of BHT in chronic viral diseases. And so I had an extensive knowledge base that allowed me to move into acute viral disease literature easily. And so I knew that this is something that didn't need this kind of panic, and that the advice that was being given that there was no treatment was just totally wrong.
Yep. And
so I wrote a book. So I spent, that's what I did in last year up through now, is I wrote a book, a 300-page book on natural antiviral self-defense.
Is that the name of it?
That's the name of it. And it's a free PDF download. I'm giving it away at Project Wellbeing. On the Steve page, you go there, you know, four items down, natural antiviral self-defense. You click on it. It's a PDF file, loads into your computer. You can save it. You can read it. And it's extensively referenced to the primary literature.
I love that. And yeah, guys, definitely check that out. And I know it's an incredible resource for sure, just knowing Steve, and I'll have to check it out myself. But I know a lot of the things that you've talked about. We've talked in the past couple of weeks, actually, pretty detailed about a number of things, because I had a family member going through COVID pretty bad. And I'll be honest too, I was not scared of COVID. And still, personally, I had COVID myself about a month and a half ago as well. I was sick for about 3 days. It was like a flu. It was like a mild flu. The fourth day I was feeling better, and by the fifth day I was normal. So, you know, as I looked at the research, as I saw the numbers, as I, you know, looked into it, the elderly, the older people, older generation, 65 plus, I know you fit into that category as well, because I think you were the same age as my grandmother, who was sick, 69. But so the elderly 65 plus tend to do really bad with this, as we talked about, or they tend to be the ones who do really bad. Not all of them do really bad, but those are the ones who do. But the younger generation, mine, 30, 40s and younger, seem to do pretty well with this. And in many cases, as you mentioned before the call, even the younger children, the flu is about three times more deadly than COVID is to the younger children for many different reasons. But I wasn't scared about this at all. But it was when it did hit home, a month and a half, 2 months ago, when my family all got it and everybody around me got it, I got it. And my grandmother ended up being hospitalized severely with it. And I got to admit, I did underestimate it, because I was so, you know, anti-shutdown, anti-lockdown, all that stuff. And I still am I'd say overall, I still am anti-shutdown, anti-lockdown, even anti-mask in many ways. Because it doesn't affect the majority of the population. Like 99% of the population is fine, but I do have a better appreciation and more respect for the virus, for the elderly, because of what it did to my grandmother and my family members. So I wanted to come back and do a podcast and really cover the people who have parents, people who have grandparents, people who have older people in their families, what the best protocol is to keep them safe. My grandmother actually had bilateral pneumonia and was very close to death at one point because, and here's the thing too, that kind of freaked me out, is she's the healthiest person before this that I knew. She never got any flus, never got any colds. Everyone around me, my family for years, we'd all get sick, but she was always the one who would never get sick. But this virus, and I believe it was created and intentionally manufactured and let go. That's another topic though. But this virus, as it is, particularly attacks the older generation. And for whatever reason, it hit her. And there's a number of reasons why it probably did, as you could probably, elaborate on. But it hit her really strong and just kind of wiped her out, and it wiped her out quick. But what I want to do in today's episode is really focus on what people can do, and people in general, but especially the older generation, even 50 plus, we can say, of what they can do to prevent this from hospitalization, what they can do to prevent death, and what you're doing, not only to prevent it, like what your protocol is, but also, you know, if they do get it, how to treat it. And then afterwards, how to treat it after they've had it, like how to recover, because your body is, you know, shocked from such a, your immune system shocked.
All the people that I know who are into functional medicine and know what they're doing, none of them have had any post-COVID malaises. None. It's zero. So the people who have post-COVID have the pre-existing conditions that would make it bad. And that's why they have the post-COVID symptoms, the lingering symptoms, that they did not handle the infection gracefully. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things that happens when people get old is that they become inefficient at absorbing and utilizing vitamin D. They tend to stay out of the sun more. And if they're in nursing homes and retirement communities, whatever caregiving that is going on around them, they're rarely taken outside. And so they have deep vitamin D deficiencies, and that manifests as susceptibility to COVID. And we also see that in the young with blacks. And the more pigmented your skin is, the more vitamin D deficient you are, and the greater the risk for COVID is. This is easy to fix. Anybody who wants to can take vitamin D. It's incredibly inexpensive. And the way I do it is 50,000 units of vitamin D once a week. So it's like 4 cents a day.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and actually my grandmother is Spanish too. Her skin is a lot darker. It's like, it's brown, basically a lot darker than my skin. So I think that would probably affect her vitamin D levels too, as well as, you know, specifically if she's not going out as much. Why do you recommend though 50,000 per week, as opposed to just like maybe 10,000 a day? Is there a reason why?
Well, if you wanted 10,000 a day, you do 50,000 twice a week. So, but it's because vitamin D is fat soluble. It doesn't have to be taken on a daily basis. And the difference in cost between, let's say, 5,000 units and 50,000 units, it's 10 times more vitamin D and only costs you 3 times more. So it's a way better deal economically. Now, if you're somebody who can't remember to take something once a week, you know, that somehow that idea of taking something once a week just doesn't click and you keep forgetting and stuff like that, then great. Buy the 5,000 size and take it every day. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for some people who hear this kind of information and go, oh, I didn't know anything about any of this stuff, and who have vitamin D levels below 20 and some people below 10, in a study where they were looking at this in a medical practice, they gave people 50,000 a day, every day, and then to get them up to 50 on the vitamin D scale from 10 or 20 up to 50, where 50 is where the mortality curve flattens out. Well, at 2 weeks, only 60% of the people were there. 50,000 a day for 2 weeks, and only just slightly more than half.
Why is that?
Well, I'm just saying that's the kind of dose it takes to get your vitamin D up quickly. Oh. Normally, if you were going out in the sun, it would be creeping up slowly over time. And so if you've got COVID, you don't want to creep. You want to slam the vitamin D, into the healthy zone so that you get the benefits, the therapeutic benefits, when the COVID is in its infectious stage rather than when it's lingering in the long COVID stage.
Yep.
You know, gotcha. Vitamin D is part of the innate immune response, which is the first line of defense against viruses. Viruses come into the body encapsulated in fat. They're called lipid envelope viruses. And the flus and the coronaviruses are lipid viruses. They're fat blobs, and they're not often recognized by the humoral immune system as they're coming into the body. They're, in a sense, cloaked in fat. And so they will infect cells at a very early stage in the immune system's response. So that makes the innate immune system the first line of defense. And that's the immune system that operates inside of cells. Then if it gets out of control and your innate immune system fails because of lack of vitamin D, lack of vitamin A, lack of zinc, lack of vitamin C, lack of glutathione, then the virus starts coming out of the cells into the body, and then the humoral immune system takes over. And the humoral immune system is operating in the fluids of the body, which is the extracellular spaces, the lymphatic fluids, the organ fluids, and in the bloodstream. That's where the antibodies are. And that's when most people think about the immune system, they think about antibodies. Well, in the innate immune reaction to it, in the early stages, there are no antibodies.
Yep.
So that's why innate immunity is really the key, and why certain things like zinc and hydroxychloroquine work pretty much only when you give them early in the infection, when the innate immune system is involved.
I was going to save this for a little longer, but what are your thoughts on, so hydroxy does work, but it works early on. Remdesivir, it seems like it doesn't really work that great. You know, maybe it's
marginal.
It's marginal. It seems like it shortens the amount of stay in the hospital by a day or two, but doesn't actually stop mortality or lower it by any significant number. And then what are your thoughts on ivermectin?
Oh, I think very highly of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the main problem it has is media, and that's both media within the medical profession and media outside of the medical profession. It's being badmouthed and slandered and libeled all over the place, just like hydroxychloroquine was. And some of that professional criticism is because the mechanism of action against viruses is unknown. Mm-hmm.
What is unknown about it? Like nobody knows it, or they don't.
They don't know how it does what it does with viruses. I mean, it's the same kind of thing that happened with antibiotics. You know, you get a cold, you know, you go in and they don't know if it's, you know, if it's bacterial or viral pneumonia. And so they give you an antibiotic and you get better. So they say, okay, because the antibiotic worked, it must have been bacterial infection. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that, you know, a significant amount of the time, 20% of these cases, it was viral and the antibiotics did work. And there is a mechanism that's now known, but it's not spread through the medical profession. But the point is, the medical profession has a bias. You know, whenever you've got these bright people who are rational dominant, they always want to understand how something works. And their tendency is to say, if I don't know how it works, that it's snake oil. It doesn't work. You know, they need to have that mechanism. And even to make up a mechanism in order to feel comfortable that something works by a known mechanism.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you recommend besides having the high vitamin D levels, optimum vitamin D levels before getting COVID? Like, are you recommending high vitamin C levels? Are you recommending a certain amount of zinc level? Are you recommending vitamin A or vitamin D? I mean, vitamin A or vitamin B, say B1, thiamine is supposedly really helpful in this. Are there certain things you're shooting for in your body and the people that you are trying to help?
All the different elements of innate and humoral immunity are on my list. But
so you're getting both.
You don't need to do vitamin D before in order to have efficacy. I mean, it's true there's a prophylactic effect, and it's true that if your system is primed with vitamin D, your innate immune system is going to do better in the earliest stages. But if you know you have COVID on day one or day two, and you take vitamin D, it will drastically reduce the time of your infection. It will drastically reduce the severity of your infection, and you will be much more likely to survive. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's been demonstrated in that Spanish study where, you know, the people who weren't given vitamin D, half of them ended up in the ICU, whereas only 2% ended up in the ICU if they got vitamin D. And that was not a really high dose of vitamin D.
How much?
It was, I think, the equivalent of like 4,000 units, where they did a double dose, you know, 3,000 units to 4,000 units. They double dose on day one. And it was a double dose in the first week. If you averaged it out per day, it was like 3,000, you know, to 4,000. And then they did, in the first week, they gave them two doses. And every week thereafter, they gave them one dose. And the mortality rate went to zero.
Wow. Just off the vitamin D. Wow.
And these people were not treated in advance. These people were treated with vitamin D after they entered the hospital.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. So to drop, you know, to drop the ICU rate by more than 90% from, I think it was 7 cents a day of vitamin D. It's just, why aren't we doing this in the United States?
Yeah. Why aren't they talking about it? Why isn't the FDA, the CDC, WHO, why they're not recommending that as like top of the list thing that we should be doing?
I can understand why they don't do it, but the real thing that makes me feel like these people are engaged in sabotage is that they didn't study it. So here they've got a study that's dramatically better than any other therapeutic that's ever been tested in the history of COVID. It's the most effective therapy ever. And a preliminary study comes out. It was only, I don't know if it was 125 people or something like that. So it's not that big a group. But the results are so dramatic, and it's never been studied on a bigger scale basis.
Yeah.
So if these people believe it couldn't have worked and all that, you know, that's denial. That's malfeasance, because people are dying.
Yeah. People are literally dying because of this every day. And it's sad. And, you know, the ivermectin works as well. I can attest to that. And you know, I've known friends personally too, you know, digging into this, and I called all resources over the last month or so. You were one of those guys that I called to just get some advice, get some tips, information. But I talked to a few people and it was sad because their parents or their grandparents or their aunts or uncles died because they didn't know what to do when they brought them to the ICU. And it's like, you watch that video
That's the first mistake. You know, when you enter a hospital environment, you're immersing yourself in the culture of the people in the hospital.
Yeah.
And that limits you. Not only will they or have they prohibited visitors as a routine, there's no way you can get vitamins through the system. Some hospitals will let you take vitamins through the system.
Yeah.
But most of them will not. They'll seize it all at the door and they will never let you get it. So if you've got a problem, you're taking zinc for it. As soon as you go into the hospital, boom, it's gone. Mm-hmm. You can't take zinc. You can't take vitamin D. You can't do any of that kind of stuff. And so they're, in a sense, sacrificing your immune competence as a matter of policy. So that's the last place you should go.
Yeah.
You know, if you can stay away from the hospital, stay away from the hospital, you know, and there may be cases where you can't, you know, you need oxygen and you don't have an oxygen concentrator at home. You may need to go into a hospital. You know, you get bacterial pneumonia on top of viral pneumonia. You know, you now need antibiotic therapy and likely intravenous antibiotic therapy. So there are many situations where you have to do that. But at home, at least you can stomp on all these nutritional supplements that are innate immune and humoral immune enhancing agents so that you will automatically do better than the people will who go into the hospital.
Yeah. And it's so true. We actually, my family and I had to fight tooth and nail to get her, my grandmother, some of these vitamins that we discussed before, the vitamin C, the vitamin D, B vitamins, some of these ones, but you know, we eventually were able to do it, but I'm telling you, it was a fight. And I can see a lot of people not fighting like that for it because they don't really know how effective it is. They also maybe don't have the time to do it, but
did
I was
you get a lawyer involved.
No, we didn't have to, but that was, okay. We came close to
because
it.
Because that's often the only way that you can really get into this. And the case of Alan Smith in New Zealand is very famous for this, where he was in a coma from the swine flu.
Yep.
And, you know, it was days of him being hospitalized. He was in a coma on full life support. In other words, they had taken over his lung and heart function with a machine.
Yep.
Here's this guy in an induced coma for months. And so they finally want to pull his plug. You know, he's a coma. He's never going to recover. His chance of recovering is zero. It's time to pull the plug. And the family says, no, you haven't tried vitamin C. We've been asking you to do vitamin C this whole time. You've refused to do it. You can't pull the plug until you give him vitamin C. So they do a deal. The hospital says, okay, it's Tuesday. We'll give him vitamin C. We'll give him vitamin C between now. And if he doesn't respond by Friday, we pull the plug. So this is Tuesday. Wednesday, his lungs are clearing. Wednesday afternoon, they're actually seeing his lungs on an x-ray. He had whiteout syndrome. Thursday, he's able to go off the respirator.
Yeah.
I mean,
incredible.
That's how fast he recovered. So at that point in time, he's no longer in danger.
Yeah.
So what did they do?
They took him off the vitamin C.
Yeah. Okay, it's okay to give a worthless treatment, vitamin C, to somebody who's in a coma is going to die because you can't hurt them. They're already as hurt as they're going to be. But now that he's recovering, a spontaneous remission, they can no longer ethically give him vitamin C. They take him off vitamin C and he lapses back into his coma.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of mentality you're dealing with in the culture of medicine, you know?
Yeah.
There's corporate culture. Well, there's medicine culture as well.
Yeah.
And vitamin C cannot work in that environment. And so that's the kind of problem you run up against when you get hospitalized that you wouldn't have at all if you can stay at home.
Yeah. It's sad. But actually, I did watch that video because you told me to check it out. And I did, probably like 20, 30 minutes long. You can find it on YouTube still. It's like some lower YouTube you know, channel or whatever. So they don't have like a ton of followers or whatever. So you can still find it. It's kind of hidden.
Yeah.
But the good story, the good news is they fought, they got the lawyer involved. They actually got him back on vitamin C. I think they might have even switched hospitals or something.
Yeah.
But after the course of like a few weeks of getting him back on the vitamin C, he made a full recovery and was out of the hospital in like a month or two fully.
And he's still alive today.
Yeah.
He's ranching. He's spending time with his loved ones. He's flying airplanes. The guy is fully recovered after being declared, you know, unsalvageable on full life support.
Yeah.
So that's the potential power you have with vitamin C, which is useful for people with severe COVID infections, where their humoral immune system is out of control. So that, sometimes that's referred to as a cytokine storm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, vitamin C shuts down cytokine storms just totally, just it's gone. And that's because vitamin C is the source of reducing power that allows the immune system to turn off. And if you don't have vitamin C because of chronic inflammation, because of lack of recycling, because of lack of supplementation, the immune system can go into overdrive and just run out of control.
Yep. How much vitamin C do you recommend? And when you're on the IV, is there any chance of hitting bile tolerance? Or does that just bypass all of that?
It's bypassed completely.
Is it?
Yeah. So there's never anybody who's on an IV, even at 200 grams IV in 24 hours, there's no diarrhea symptoms.
So there's basically no overdosing of it at all, right? Because those are the only real symptoms, so, overdose, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose, you know, that, you know, 200 grams a day is, you know, a handful of vitamin C. I suppose if you were trying to give a kilogram by IV, that something bad would happen.
Yeah.
But you can't even dissolve a kilogram of vitamin C in a reasonable amount of fluid. So the point is that for all practical purposes, you can't really, you know, hurt anybody or kill anybody with vitamin C unless you blow the pH, you know, the acidity. It's too alkaline, it's too acid, and you give them acidosis or alkalosis, or it's the electrolytes are out of balance and you induce some kind of electrolyte crisis in somebody where the IV formulation is wrong. It's possible, but it's not the vitamin C that kills the people. It's the lack of potassium or the presence of too much calcium or these kinds of things, or the acid and alkali load that kill the people. It's not the vitamin C itself.
Yeah. How, I saw your talk with, Andrew Saul as well. Dr. Andrew Saul, I think you interviewed him on the Silicon Health Institute. Really fascinating talk, because I had him on the show a few years back too. Very interesting guy. I've always been.
It's the Silicon Valley Health Institute,
SVHI.com
and .org.
Yep.
And they have a YouTube channel, and his talk is on that YouTube channel.
Yeah. So do you work with them or for them? Or?
I have in the past. I'm not doing it now, but I did for the last year. You know, I thought they should go internationally. And so we set up a Zoom thing, and I did, you know, four shows. I helped produce four shows a month. So we did it every week. We went from once a month organization to a once a week organization at some point in like April or May or something like that. And we did, you know,
a ton of shows,
150 shows or something like that.
Nice.
And some really talented people.
Yeah. It was very interesting having you. I mean, I'm just looking at like two brilliant minds, and you're kind of going back and forth on it. I'm like, this is so cool. And I had really enjoyed that talk. But one of the things I was thinking of is, how effective can you get with reaching the levels of IV vitamin C through oral supplementation? And also, you asked him in particular too about liposomal vitamin C, and he didn't really dismiss it, but he kind of said that it wasn't really justified because it's so expensive and you can kind of do the same thing with regular vitamin C. What are your thoughts on that though? Because I've had a feeling that
I have a slightly different take.
I kind of thought you thought a little bit differently. Yeah. Can you explain that though?
Sure. You know, I think that liposomal vitamin C is something that most people shouldn't use, and not because it's expensive, because, you know, when you're talking about a dollar a gram, that's still within the realm of most people's budgets. If you want to do 10 grams a day, okay, $10 a day, that's way cheaper than going into the hospital.
Yeah.
You know, but the problem with liposomal vitamin C is that the liposomes themselves are made from polyunsaturated fatty acids. So it's fat.
Yep.
And it's unsaturated fat, which is susceptible to oxidation. And it's omega-6 polyunsaturated fats and not omega-3. Mm-hmm. Content of omega-3 is minimal. So if you were to be taking this on a daily basis, you would unbalance your fatty acids, and you would be exposing yourself to the potential of fat rancidity. You would increase that risk.
Yep.
So I say, you know, liposomal vitamin C is fine, but it's the emergency thing. It's in your medicine chest. You use it when, you know, you catch COVID, for example, and your life is on the line, and it's all about short-term benefits. And, you know, you'll worry about the long-term stuff when you live, mm-hmm. you know? And so, and it's on some level comparable to vitamin C in terms of the ability to get the vitamin C deep in the body. And IVs do it by flooding the body with vitamin C, which drives some of it down into the deep tissues. And the liposomal does it by smuggling the vitamin C down into the deep tissues. So on some level, they're comparable. Whether or not 10 grams or 6 grams of liposomal vitamin C is equal to 24 grams of IV vitamin C or 50 grams of IV vitamin C, I don't know. That kind of issue is wide open, and Saul is right to question that kind of issue. You know, mm-hmm. clinically, we don't have that experience, but that's how Alan Smith responded in the hospital. They smuggled in liposomal C to rescue him, get him out of his coma so they could check him out of the hospital to complete his recovery. So, but oral vitamin C is capable of delivering massive quantities of vitamin C into the body. And what's useful about it is that it's a proportional delivery system. In other words, there's a limit to how much vitamin C you can get in, and that limit changes with the severity of your infection. The sicker you are, the more vitamin C you can absorb without having diarrhea. Mm-hmm. So not only is the vitamin C capable of getting up to 50 grams a day, which would be comparable to an IV. It's even could be double what some of the IVs are in some hospitals in the USA, and even quadruple some of them. But you get information when you do a bowel tolerance dosing protocol. You get information about how sick you are, and that really makes a difference in your fear versus comfort in your own survival.
Yeah.
So if you're doing the vitamin C protocol that I describe in the book, where you're taking 1 gram every hour on the hour, and then it's 1 gram every 50 minutes, and then it's 1 gram every 45 minutes, and then it's 1 gram every 35 minutes. If you're doing that kind of protocol where you're taking that gram more and more and more frequently, your vitamin C dose is going up. And as long as you don't have diarrhea, you're not getting the loosening of the stool from the overflow of vitamin C out of the GI tract, then that's bounding the limit of how sick you are. As soon as you get up to the point that it starts loosening your stool, that tells you exactly how sick you are. Mm-hmm. So if you're at 10 grams a day, you're not very sick at all. If you're at 20 grams a day, you're seriously sick. If you're at 40 grams a day, you're really, really sick, you know? And some people can get over 100 grams a day without getting loose stool, because the absorption of the vitamin C is in proportion to the body's need.
Yeah. How about those esterases out there? Is it recommended to take that when you're trying to hit that higher dose, or does like the calcium or say the magnesium ascorbate, would that mess up? Because you're taking such a high amount, would that mess anything else up? Because it has those things and other things like, say, rutin or quercetin or some of the other things that are kind of mixed into those esterases. Do you recommend the buffered C or just basic vitamin C?
For oral, if it's in capsules, I don't. It appears that the body wants the acidity.
Okay.
As opposed to the buffering. And when you're dealing with buffering, you've got sodium, potassium, calcium, magnesium, sometimes trace quantities of things like zinc. And those are electrolytes, and those have to be balanced. Mm-hmm. Whereas ascorbic acid, that's just something your kidneys take care of. If you've got too much acid in your system, your urine gets acidified. If you don't have enough acid, your urine gets alkalinized. So your kidneys are really good at buffering the body, the vitamin C. The issue is that if you were to take your vitamin C as powder and dissolve it in water and drink it, your taste buds are going to give you a different signal than your digestive system will. And so you, I can take, for example, 12 grams of ascorbic acid a day. You know, mm-hmm. triple aught capsules. You know, I can take 12 of those a day as ascorbic acid and not have any kind of acidosis or adverse acidic effect. But if I take that 12 grams of vitamin C and put it in a glass of water, my taste buds will react and say, that's too much, that's too acidic.
Interesting. I didn't know that, actually, because yeah, there was a few years ago, I was on, I had a regular pneumonia. It was probably about 5-6 years ago. And I was doing the liquid. I mean, yeah, the liquid, the crystals, mixing it in with the liquid. And I took about 30,000 and I was really, really sick at the time, 30,000. But then I hit like the diarrhea point and it was like, all right, I got to shut this down. It isn't where I kind of got scared off of it because of that. But I was also thinking later on, like if I had done the capsules alone, just the vitamin C, would that be different? And that kind of answers the question, right?
No, it would have been the same.
It would have?
In other words, yeah. I mean, the only difference with the capsules is it hides the acidity from your taste buds.
Okay.
But, you know, if it's a veggie cap, an hour after you swallow it, it's broken. And the vitamin C is dissolved in your stomach contents. And if it's a gelatin capsule, 25 minutes after you swallow it, the capsule has disappeared. So in a sense, that same amount of vitamin C would enter your system. And, you know, what I find fascinating is that when I've looked into that whole issue of vitamin C and IVs, so two different companies make intravenous vitamin C fluids pre-manufactured for, you know, for hospitals and the medical offices. So you just, in a sense, hook up your IV tube and just run it straight from the bottle. It's sterilized vitamin C. And the pH of those it's not 7. It's not 7.4, which is the pH of your blood, or 7.35. It's like 5.9, 5.5, you know, 6.1. It's more than 10 times more acidic than your bloodstream. Really? And that's what works clinically. So somehow your body wants that acidity. And so ascorbic acid gives your body that acidity. Now, I think that it probably wouldn't hurt that much if your vitamin C was slightly buffered. So if I take vitamin C straight and it's got a pH of about 3, which is like lemon juice, you know, just, you know.
It tastes the same too.
Yeah. If I add just a small amount of baking soda to it to bring it from pH 3 to pH 4 or so, which would be like orange juice, I'm fine with that level of acidity.
Yep.
And I've done it with milk of magnesia as well. Just a little tiny, you know, micro spoonful of milk of magnesia in, stir it up. It gets kind of milky white, and then the vitamin C and the magnesium react to form magnesium ascorbate, and it turns translucent, clear. And that works great to take the edge off the acidity.
After spending last summer on the sidelines, we're all ready to get back out there and make this year's lounge season an epic one. So Bespoke Post is here to take your sand, sun, and surf game to the next level with a new lineup of must-have Box of Awesome collections for guys. My favorite Box of Awesome is the Weekender Box. I have to say, this is one of the nicest bags I've ever owned. The special edition Weekender bag is beautiful and built to last. And I can't wait to show off this beautiful bag this summer when I travel around. It's going to be awesome. Bespoke Post only sends guys the best stuff every month. From breezy summer styles and grooming goods to travel and outdoor gear, Box of Awesome has collections for every part of your life. I personally can't wait to check out the Alchemy Box because I can't wait to stock up my house with the pro-level cocktail wares they have. To get started, take the quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick the right Box of Awesome for you. Each box costs only $45 but has over $70 worth of gear inside. Get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter the code ELITEMAN at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code ELITEMAN for 20% off your first box.
Is there any way, and this is kind of a, I don't know if this is a safe question to ask, but is there any way to actually get that IV, the liquid IV vitamin C for home use? Can people do that at home themselves? Have you ever done that by yourself at home?
I haven't. You have to be taught how to stick yourself with a needle. You have to be taught the IV procedure, but a lot of people are. You know, it's not like you can get a phlebotomist that'll come in and tell you how to give yourself injections, B12 injections. People do insulin injections, and you can do IVs. It's just there's a skill involved in doing that right.
So
you just have to have the bags and the vitamin C and the needles, all that equipment, and that's all has to be done by prescription, at least in the United States and the UK and France and other places like that, that, you know, Germany. I mean, it may be that in third world countries, you might be able to buy IV equipment over the counter. And some Asian and South American countries may allow that as well. So it's important when you're dealing with a pandemic, not to have that equipment in the possession of your doctor. You know, one of the big, huge liabilities of the lockdown is that they lock down doctor's offices. And so a lot of people did not have access to IV vitamin C because of that moronic policy.
Yeah.
And several doctors did stay open. And one of them, Brownstein, was interviewed on the SVHI channel. He and his staff stayed there and they ran a clinic. They all got these suits, complete exposure suits, and were doing medicine in their parking lot.
Yeah.
People would drive up and they would be checked in and they would drive over and they'd be given IVs while they're sitting in their car. And
that's incredible. You know,
it was like, it was this massive thing. And all of his people recovered incredibly fast. You know, it was all this, like your experience, you know, 3 days and that's it, it's done with.
Yeah.
And they were also set up with nebulizers and instructions on how to use iodine and hydrogen peroxide and things like this as part of their therapy at home, in between the IVs that they got, you know, in the parking lot. And it was like it was an amazing effort of this doctor and his staff. Just astounding. And that ended up becoming a federal legal matter, and the FBI shut him down.
That's crazy.
It's hard to even imagine having a Hollywood movie with that kind of an element in the script and having it get produced. It's so unbelievable. And yet, you know, people say that couldn't happen here. Well, it did happen here.
Yeah. Truth is stranger than fiction in 2021. And yeah, I ended up, you mentioned him before. I got his book. So I'm in a couple chapters in. Fascinating guy, incredible book. I forget the actual name of it, but it's something about virus. You probably have it sitting around too. I have it back in my bookshelf.
I have it here somewhere, but you know, it's.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about him too, and the nebulizers and all that stuff. But before, last thing on the vitamin C is, what do you like the IV bars and stuff that they have? What do you recommend if people wanted to do the IV, the vitamin C, either like prophylactically or if they are kind of starting to get like, you know, symptoms of being sick, like flu-like symptoms, COVID-like symptoms? What how much do you recommend people take in for a vitamin C, like at an IV bar or at their doctors who have this stuff?
I think it's unnecessary.
Really?
You don't need IV vitamin C if you know in advance what's going to happen and you're prepared. I mean, you know, even if you're elderly and you know what you're doing, you might be at risk, but the chances are that you can catch it and have less than a week of flu-like symptoms just from doing oral vitamin C. It's all a matter of being prepared so that you stomp on it at the earliest possible time. So if you're tracking your body temperature, you're tracking your oxygen saturation, you know, pulse oximeter, you see your oxygen, you know, normally it's between 94 and 99, 94 maybe when you're exercising or walking around or gardening or something, and 99 when you're just at rest, then, you know, that's fine. And all of a sudden it dips you know, you start to feel bad, you start to run a fever, you get a scratchy throat, you have, you know, shortness of breath or something like that. You look at your O2 monitor, it's down to 93, it's down to 89. Okay, boom, immediately, vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin A, zinc, sublingual zinc, hydroxychloroquine, one tablet of hydroxychloroquine if you have it on hand, ivermectin, whatever it is, all of those different things, you stomp on it immediately. Chances are your innate immune system is going to win the battle before it ever gets to your humoral immune system.
Gotcha.
And then when it does get to your humoral immune system, it'll be a mop-up operation instead of a crisis.
Caldera Lab has high-performance men's skincare, and it combines pharmaceutical-grade science, nature's purest and most potent ingredients, and sustainable business practices. They have a product called The Good, which is a clinically proven, multifunctional, non-toxic formula of 27 active botanicals meticulously infused over 4 weeks in an EcoCert Cosmos-certified facility. It's formulated with wild-harvested, non-GMO, and organic ingredients, and is a lightweight, all-in-one treatment designed to restore, nourish, and protect a man's skin. Caldera Lab is the first men's skincare in the USA to be certified by both EcoCert and Made Safe. I've tried The Good now for a number of weeks, and I absolutely love it. I got to be honest, I wasn't quite sure if I'd love it because I'm not a huge skincare guy and I haven't taken a ton of different skincare products in the past. Although I've taken a few, I didn't really love the results I got with them. But after taking The Good for just a couple of days, I noticed almost right away how more refreshed and nourished and just overall better looking my skin felt and looked. The Good really is that good. And that's why I'm recommending it for you guys to take as well. It really is, in my personal opinion, the very best skincare product for men on the market. And by the way, GQ agrees with me as well. They call it the best natural face serum for men. So whether you're tackling dry skin, acne scars, wrinkles, or just want to do you and invest in healthier skin, kind of like me, this is the one product I recommend using. So try it right now. I'm telling you, you're going to absolutely love this serum. It is incredible. But for whatever reason, if you don't love it, there is a 100% risk-free guarantee. So if you don't love it, you can send it back and get a full refund. Right now, Caldera has a special offer for our audience. Receive 20% off your first Caldera Lab purchase of The Good. Go to calderalab.com and use discount code ELITEMAN, one word, all caps, at checkout. That's CALDERALAB.com and use the code ELITEMAN for 20% off your first order.
Now, I was gonna wait a little bit for this one, but I think I know your take on it, but I want to hear your take explicitly, and that is, of course, the vaccines. And what are your thoughts on the vaccines? Do you think it helps? Do you think it's effective? Because honestly, in my case, I'm very anti-COVID vaccine, anti-flu vaccine, because, you know, for the many reasons. But at this point, even like my grandmother who had it very severely, I'm kind of worried of the next strains that are going to be coming out for her. So I still am against her getting it. And I'm of the belief of what you just said, the prophylactic use of some of these supplements, vitamin A, D, C, even ivermectin, the drug use, or hydroxychloroquine, whatever you can get your hands on immediately when you kind of start to get symptoms. But there's a small part of me now in the back of my brain that's like, does it actually stop people who are at risk for death or hospitalization? Does it prevent those types of things? Is it potentially worth it for someone like my grandmother who had it before, who's now petrified of it, getting it in the future, to maybe get the vaccine to prevent her from the worst case scenario? Again, I'm definitely not a fan of the vaccines, but there's a tiny percentage of me that's kind of like, you know,
yeah.
Well, what's
on
the
some level, I'm a fan of the vaccines. The mRNA vaccines I consider to be brilliant. But the problem is that brilliance is no guarantee of safety or efficacy. And the numbers that they're citing for 95% efficacy for the mRNA vaccines, those numbers are collected at 2 weeks post-vaccination, which is no real-world test at all. In other words, you know, you want this protection to last for 2 months.
They test them just for 2 weeks.
And wow. 9 months. Not 2 weeks.
Wow.
So, that's a marketing scam. It's like, you know, selecting a 2 week measurement point is rigging the game to give you the best possible numbers as early as possible in the situation. Okay. Yeah. So, but the idea of being able to produce a vaccine that's efficacious without an oxidative insult, without the adjuvant that's part of the classic vaccines, which is what is the most dangerous part of a vaccine. You've got an adjuvant and you've got an antigen. And turns out the antigen is relatively minor risk. It's the adjuvant that's really dangerous to people. And to produce a vaccine with no adjuvant on it, in my opinion, is it's brilliant. It's smart. It's a breakthrough on some level in terms of that risk assessment.
Yeah.
But I mean, I can go into all of these other issues with it. First of all, the mRNA packaging system. They take chemicals, they mix it with the RNA, it condenses into lipid nanoparticles. Those chemicals that they use to package the mRNA have never been tested for safety. They've Yeah. never been tested for safety in animals. They've never been tested for safety in human beings. And they're fatty acids and fatty alcohols of a type that do not occur in nature. So, you know, that's the question I have is, how are these things metabolized? And I've been asking this question of professionals and chemists and biologists, and nobody's been able to answer the question yet.
Wow.
So, you know, that just gives you an example of how new this technology is. It's all less than 10 years old. And in that 10 years, we've gone from immune-dependent enhancement, where 100% or near 100% of the animals died when they were exposed to the virus after the vaccine, to being able to give it to humans and not have that immune IDE reaction to it. That's all happened in less than 10 years. So the idea that this is somehow safe is highly questionable. And the word experimental accurately defines what these vaccines are. They're highly experimental.
Yeah.
And so the question is, what's the trade-off between, you know, risking something that's highly experimental versus not doing it? And the answer would be people like you who could survive COVID in 3 days. It's, you know, I consider it a really bad risk to do something like that that's that experimental.
Yeah.
But when you're dealing with a 98-year-old grandmother or, you know, 92-year-old grandfather, that the trade-off in those risks may be dramatically different, especially if they're existing with some kind of cardiovascular problem or diabetes or some other risk factor that is fundamentally compromising their immune reaction to this. This may be the kind of thing to do for them. I think that what we're seeing is that the short-term reported side effects from the vaccines are relatively mild and anticipated. In other words, they're fairly well tolerated. You know, most of the people get the injections. They might have, some people might be totally asymptomatic. Some people might have a sore arm. Some people might have a day of malaise, but on the whole, 99% of people sail through the vaccination process with minimal complaints. So, at least on that level, it appears that the acute danger is manageable and is acceptable. And they can actually give you informed consent on that basis.
Yeah.
But the long-term effects, what's going on, how long the vaccination will last, how long the resistance will last and all that, they can't give you informed consent because they just don't know.
Yeah.
And so we have all of these unknowns that make it so I won't do the vaccine for probably 2 years.
But you would potentially do it in 2 years after seeing what happens?
Well, I don't know. I would consider it. I mean, it would have to be something that would be, that would alert me to some kind of an issue, because I'm, you know, my vitamin D is up above 50. I have vitamin A. I've got all these things waiting for a COVID infection. I have enough vitamin C to bring 10 of my family members through a COVID crisis. You know, I have instructions to my sweetheart that if she's going to have an oxygen issue or, you know, thing, that she'll call me and I'll drive with all the supplies to her house and take care of her. And so, you know, I've got it all set up to handle this intelligently. And a lot of the, some of this is therapeutic and some of it is preventive. So selenium, for example, it's a huge viral defense nutritional. And it probably matters that you have your selenium high before you get infected. Much more so, because first of all, the forms of selenium are not the form that you're actually in your body, but it's not something that you can raise rapidly. And even though there is some evidence that clinical use of selenium does help with COVID, it's not as spectacular as what you would see with, let's say, vitamin D or vitamin C, where it's like, you know, 3 days versus 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so I have selenium in my water. I have drinking water, filtered drinking water, and I put selenium in it. So every time I drink a glass of water, this, you know, it's got, I'm getting selenium. So my selenium is in the top quartile. I'm protected with selenium. I have bottles of zinc on hand. I have zinc throat spray.
Yep. That's great. Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, that's what hydroxychloroquine does, is it mobilizes zinc. Well, if you take enough zinc, you will overcome a type 2 zinc deficiency without the need for hydroxychloroquine. I've got that. I know that vitamin D works with vitamin A. So I know to take a lot of vitamin D, let's say 100,000 units of vitamin D in the first few days of a COVID infection. So I know what to do. So I'm not at risk. So I would not need the vaccine to stay alive. I might need the vaccine to travel. I may need the vaccine to be to not be arrested. I may need the vaccine in order to have my family members be comfortable with me at a family gathering. I mean, those are the kind of things where the vaccine may have an appeal that is bureaucratic rather than medical.
Yeah. Do you put any stock into, or have you heard anything about the vaccine potentially making you more susceptible to upcoming variants of COVID? There's some little research, I think, that's kind of coming out here and there about that. But then there's other people like, you know, the CDC head, Rochelle something, that's saying like that's totally false. And of course, she's going to say that anyways. But what's your take on that?
That's public relations. Yeah. You know? And anytime you have a theory in its earliest stages, it's probably, you know, worth a little bit more than the paper it's printed on. And, you know, even if the CDC's dismissal of it was printed on paper, it'd be worth even less. So that those are the kinds of issues that we don't have. So it's very clear that the vaccines are specific for COVID-19 and a variety of strains that are close enough in shape to meet the antibodies that are induced by the vaccines. So that's narrow. When you're dealing with vitamin A and vitamin D and selenium and zinc, those are innate immune enhancing agents that work against all viruses, not only all strains of COVID, but all strains of coronaviruses, all strains of flu viruses, all strains of you know, protein envelope viruses. It's a general response. So you don't have to worry about what virus it is. You're going to have that innate resistance to all of the viruses in the world, including the ones that would be not handled by it. So even those people who are vaccinated can follow a functional medicine preventive approach. There's no reason why you can't stack, you know, the immune enhancements on top of a vaccine. And there's no reason why you can't address insulin resistance, leptin resistance, cardiovascular disease, vascular inflammation, vitamin C deficiency, all of those kinds of pre-existing conditions that we know increase morbidity and mortality in COVID. They're all reversible. Mm-hmm. And this is known. I mean, the functional medicine people know how to do this. I can describe ways to reverse all of those kinds of conditions. So the only reason not to do it is because your doctor doesn't tell you about it or because it's complicated. I mean, it's not actually expensive, but it could be a fair amount of trouble in that you'd have to change your lifestyle and your habits. And there's nothing more difficult for human beings than to change their habits.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very true. I mean, just look at the, you know, obesity rate in the United States. It's kind of a clear-cut sign of that very thing. But so you, from what you've seen though, that the people that the vaccines do actually lead to a higher susceptibility to catching one of these new strains for whatever reason, like weakening the immune system, or is there anything else like physiologically that you know is at play there?
Well, the whole problem with not addressing innate immunity is that your immune system has, it's like short attention span theater. It's like your immune system has, hyperactivity disorder, you know, as inability to concentrate on a broad number of subjects at the same time. And it tends to be focused on something. So it tends to be focused on specific things. And so that's what you want. You want your immune system to be generalized so that it'll react to all the different things that would be a threat. And then you want it to turn off if those things are not a threat, like food particles. You don't want your immune system fighting your food. And you don't want your immune system fighting something where the battle's already been won.
Yep.
So if you have a low-level infection and you have antibodies to that infection and the antibody level drops back down, you want your immune system to relax so that if and when a big insult comes in that's life-threatening, your immune system has the capacity to focus on it and devote its resources. And so that's one of the potential problems that you have in sensitizing the immune system to a particular antigen, is that you may then make it monolithic for that antigen, and it may then make something else worse. This is called vaccine interference when it deals with a vaccination for one disease that causes an increase in the infection or morbidity or mortality of another one. And this was seen in American soldiers who were vaccinated in 2019 against the flu, who had a more severe reaction to COVID in 2020, a year later.
Yeah.
They paid the price. And so now we know that vaccine interference is one of those potential safety issues that needs to be assessed in looking at these mRNA vaccines and all. And because that's a next year phenomenon, it can't be done before 2022.
Yeah.
The flu season in 2022. That's the earliest we're going to get that kind of data. Now, there may be other kinds of effects as well that are going on, where vitamin C, for example, is needed to allow the immune system to turn off so that it can then focus on something else. And so when you give a vaccine that has inflammation, and it's pretty clear that these mRNA vaccines and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and others, they do cause an inflammatory reaction. Even spike protein itself has now been demonstrated in a theoretical model to irritate the vascular system and to potentially cause heart damage. And that's what the vaccines are doing, is they're inducing spike protein expression. Instead of it coming from the virus, it's coming from an artificial route, but it's still spike protein. So anytime you have vascular inflammation, you're going to take down your vitamin C a notch, and maybe two or three notches. So what happens when your vitamin C goes down is your immune system loses its selectivity. It loses its ability to modulate itself so it can respond at a high level to one thing and a low level to something else.
Yep.
And that is a potential hazard to the vaccines.
Does it also work in the same way if you already had one of these strains of COVID, like say for me, for instance, or my grandmother, like, going forward, does it make us sort of monolithic in one COVID variant, but then also make us more susceptible to the next COVID variant coming up just because we already were able to overcome it? Or is that totally different?
Maybe. One of the things that we know, in our modern age of science is that viral replication is very inefficient. Yeah, so that for every virus that's complete and intact that comes out, there's 10 viruses that are in pieces throughout the system. And for every accurately replicated, at least 1% of all viral copying results in errors. And so it makes sense to me that anybody who's reacting to real COVID, an actual SARS-CoV-2 infection, is going to have many different strains of COVID in their system to lesser degrees. It's going to start off being one, but it's rapidly going to degenerate into a plethora of them. And some of those alternate strains may be responsible for long COVID, for those lingering symptoms. If something mutates sideways and then escapes 98% of immune surveillance, instead of having it be 99.9%, it's only 98%, a little bit of it, you know, persists, that can cause, you know, chronic viral inflammation in the same way that herpes does, or CMV does, or Epstein-Barr virus does. So yes, that's possible that that would happen. But as far as I know, there's little specific data other than the observation that people who've been vaccinated have a wider variety of strains in them than people who have COVID.
Okay.
So it appears that the surgical mRNA is taking out the closely replicated viruses and allowing the mistaken replication, the variants, the strains to survive and persist.
Okay. Do you think also to the other end of that, that people who've had COVID, similar to the people who had the vaccine, but the people who had COVID already can fight off the new strains even better because their body can recognize it, especially if they've had those mutations going on, you know, different replications of the virus. They've already had like a exposure to it. They've had, you know, antibodies, et cetera, built up. So do you think it goes that way as well? Or could it go that way?
It could. Yeah, it could. I mean, I mentioned that, but the whole point though, is that this is very simple to prevent. All you have to do is take 2 to 4 grams of vitamin C a day and be aware of yourself so that you know when and if you get sick.
Yeah.
So if somebody is dealing with COVID in an unsupplemented state, their vitamin C level is going to be, the intake from food and stuff is going to be, you know, 50 or 100 milligrams, you know. And if you're taking a gram of vitamin C a day, it's 1,000. You're 10 times more vitamin C. That's giving your immune system a regulatory control mechanism that is way beyond what you would normally deal with. And a gram of vitamin C is 2 cents, 5 cents, you know, that kind of price. It's you know, maybe 10 cents if it's all fully packaged in a capsule or a timed release pill or something like that, or fully buffered. But, you know, on the whole, you know, 10 cents a day is way below the level where people have to, you know, worry. I mean, it's less than cigarettes. It's less than a glass of wine a day. It's less than many different things that we do on a regular basis without even thinking about the costs. Mm-hmm. So that vitamin C gives your immune system a control mechanism that minimizes all of those kinds of risks regarding strains and immune systems not being able to target something because it's overinvested in something else.
Gotcha.
So I don't see that as being a challenge to anybody who takes a functional medicine approach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you know how to biohack COVID, you're in a position to protect yourself into the foreseeable future.
Even with all the variants and all that stuff. And
that's right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people, when they talk about, you know, the variations being more infective, it's like saying, okay, you know, the Porsche is just not, you know, it's just too fast for the police cars. And so, well, all of a sudden now this crook has got a Maserati. You know, it's like going from, you know, this level of infection to this level of infection when flus and colds are down here, in the basement. And, you know, there, The SARS virus was engineered for a particular enhanced affinity for the ACE2 receptor based on the gain of function studies that were being conducted on it. This was part of their research goal, was to assess to what extent does the optimization, the shift in optimization for bats and pangolins and other animals to humans, what risk does that entail for us? And that to study that, this is what was funded by the US government and other governments, was to study that kind of issue, you need to take that part of the virus and optimize it for the human ACE2 receptor. And so that it's already in that realm of being much more infectious for humans than the standard viruses would be, than other coronaviruses would be. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that. So the fact that Mother Nature can do a better job than the technicians, you know, in designing that fit, you know, it did surprise me. You know, mm-hmm. I thought that the people would be better, but it could be that, you know, the gain of function people had 50 strains of coronavirus and only one of them leaked out. And it wasn't the worst. It wasn't the most effective. And Mother Nature is merely optimizing a process that we actually didn't quite get it right.
Yep. Back to Brownstein's work for a moment. Do you have a nebulizer at home? Would you consider using that? And, you know, if the vitamins alone and the supplementation didn't prove as effective initially and then kind of started to exacerbate your symptoms anyways, would you use a nebulizer? Do you recommend that?
I have two nebulizers and I have 10 nebulizer heads.
Wow.
So I'm set up, and I have, you know, at any given time when I'm doing nebulization, I'll have an iodine head and a clotal silver head and a hydrogen peroxide head, whatever it is I'm doing. And so I'll just pop the tube off and stick it on this one and, you know, do some colloidal silver. And then the next time I do it, I might do some iodine, you know, and it's just swapping the tube to the heads that allows me to switch back and forth between different things that I want to nebulize. You can nebulize vitamin C, you can nebulize, you know, all kinds of different therapeutics.
What can you recommend, like a nebulizing brand or something for guys to check out? Me to check out too. Is there like what is something that you can look at though?
There's
what are they called?
They're just called nebulizers. There's a dozen major brands out there, and they vary from $50 to $500 depending upon whether they're portable, how much noise they make, how much nebulization they will do at any given time. And so generally the more money you spend, the more the less kind of inhales, the more foggy your nebulizing mist is. And also the more expensive one ones tend to be quieter.
Okay. What's the protocol though? You just put it in there and do it for like a half hour, or how long do these things last for?
Well, it depends on what you're doing, but for iodine, you don't even need to nebulize it. You can just breathe the iodine smell in through your sinuses, and there's enough iodine deposited to have antiviral and antibacterial and antifungal effects.
Wow.
So if you can smell it, it's actually doing something in your sinuses. Now, if you've got a lung issue, and it's got to get deep into your lungs, smelling it won't work. It needs to be nebulized.
Yeah.
But, you know, the amount of surface area you have in your lungs is bigger than all of the skin on the outside of your body. So it's a good tissue for absorbing things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've, you know, for bacterial, for viral infections, I don't think colloidal silver offers any advantage. But if you have a viral infection with a bacterial infection on top of it, or a fungal infection on top of it, then the colloidal silver works great. I like the 100% metallic colloidal silvers because they just go, if you don't have an oxidizing condition or infection, they just go right through you. You just basically pee it all out. But iodine is part of the Brownstein's protocol, and it's been very effective. And it's iodide is antibacterial, antifungal, and iodine is as well. So I-, which is the clear form of iodine, and I2, which is molecular iodine, is the brownish, dark-colored iodine. They're both powerful antimicrobials.
Wow. And what about the hydrogen peroxide? Do you recommend that? Because that seems like such a weird thing to put into your body, especially if you're breathing it through.
It's not.
Is it very?
Your body makes hydrogen peroxide all the time.
Yes, but
every minute
safe?
Of every day, your body is making hydrogen peroxide. It's not. I mean, your body makes bleach on a regular basis too.
Does it?
So it's not like these are toxins. These are part of your natural biological metabolism. And hydrogen peroxide has the benefit and the liability. The benefit is that it's a biological molecule, and there's an enzyme system for breaking it down. So the more you use it, the stronger that enzyme system gets, and the more you're protected from it. So that's a safety aspect. And the liability issue is that you can take enough to hurt yourself. You know, you buy hydrogen peroxide in the store at 3%. If you nebulize 3% straight away, you're probably going to have a problem with the tissue pain from the oxidative stress. Mm-hmm. Probably going to be too strong.
Yeah.
You're probably going to have to dilute it down to 0.5% to make it utilizable. And some people get freaked out when you ask them to do a recipe where, you know, say 5 parts saline and 1 part hydrogen peroxide. They go, oh no, I don't know how to do that. So that can be daunting. And if you're buying hydrogen peroxide and on Amazon at 10% or 20% or 30%, you have a dilution issue, which is different. It's maybe even more extreme. So when people have that kind of iodine, I say, just do it by drops. Take your nebulizer head, fill it with saline, and add 1 drop of iodine or 1 drop of hydrogen peroxide, and then do your inhale. And if you get a slight sting that lasts for 5 to 10 seconds and then disappears, it's perfect.
Really? That's normal?
That's normal. That means you've got a bit of oxidative stress that is capable of killing microbes that are on the surface of your sinuses, on the outer surface of your sinuses. And then the next day, you know, after you stop getting a sting, put a 2nd drop in it and then a 3rd drop. So that you slowly ramp the strength up as your body's defense mechanism ramps up, that you're keeping the hydrogen peroxide level slightly higher than your body's ability to detoxify it so that you can maintain an antimicrobial effect from it.
Nice. Who even thought of this idea to nebulize that? That seems like such a great idea, but you know, you haven't heard many people like talking about that.
Yeah, but it's part of the way the immune system fights things. Your immune system does hydrogen peroxide and superoxide and hydroxyl radicals, all as a means of fighting microbes. And, you know, hydrogen peroxide is an effective sterilizing agent. So if you soak your mouth guard in hydrogen peroxide, it's sterilized.
Yep. Yeah, it's true. And, Brownstein had really good effect. I think in the book he said it over 100 people came to him and they all got better within like hours, if not like days, yeah. The latest, like in a couple of days, he wiped out COVID.
They had immediate relief of certain symptoms, like for example, shortness of breath.
Yep.
That could happen in minutes to hours. And the COVID experience was a day to maybe 4 days. That's the range. You know, some people would be fine the next day. Some people it would take 2 or 3 days and rarely 4 days. So that's way above the average. When you talk about hospitalizations, they measure that time in weeks.
Wow, that's incredible. And they tried to shut the guy down and have him, you know, the FBI investigate him and all this stuff. But I think
they threatened to prosecute him for his website.
Wow. Yeah, he had to pull a bunch of articles and stuff, he said, right?
And also one of his articles that he was writing on Google Docs, Google killed it.
Wow.
It was a scientific paper that he was writing.
That's crazy.
And Google killed it.
That's incredible. I wonder what he's doing now, though, to try to get past all that stuff, because I did hear
he's still
trying to fight.
It.
Is he?
Still doing it, yeah.
Good for him.
I mean, so, you know, that typically the FBI, when they do that kind of thing, will have some kind of issue with claims or something like that. And so, you know, and they will act on behalf of the state, and the state will regulate things like medical conduct. And then there's the Federal Trade Commission, which handles larger claims. And they're now saying that anybody making a therapeutic claim for vitamin C is in violation of law by making unsubstantiated and untruthful, exaggerated claims. Even though it's 100% truthful, the government can say what it wants. And the only way you can get justice is to fight them in court at a cost that typically runs about $500,000 to $1.5 million.
Wow. That's insane.
So, you know, basically, it's a chilling environment to suppress innovation. They just make that price so high that only the rich and only the dedicated will take on the government.
Yeah, that's sad, man. Just a couple more questions and we will be wrapping up soon, man. I appreciate your time. One more thing Brownstein mentions in the book is ozone therapy. Have you ever experienced
ozone is not a natural oxidizing agent. It's a molecule that doesn't occur in the human body naturally.
Okay, so you don't recommend it or?
No, I do. I think it's very, very, very beneficial and excellent. And the Germans have proven that for a variety of different therapies and
Ebola,
not only
too,
anti-infective
right?
therapies, but also for joint reconstructions. They can save people who need artificial hips and artificial knees and stuff like that. They can save them by doing ozone injections into the joint capsule and encouraging rebuilding effects. Ozone seems to have this very specific effect for helping bones, ligaments, tendons heal. And the Germans have been doing it for, I think, 4 decades and commercially for 3. So this is mainstream therapy there. And in this country, I think you can still get prosecuted by state medical boards for even talking about ozone therapy as part of your practice.
Wow. Have you ever used it? Personally?
Well, no, but I've had multiple people that I know use it. I'm lucky, you know, genetically and you know, in terms of lifestyle, I have very few complaints. I mean, I had knee problems when I was a teenager and knee surgery on both knees, but I just spent, you know, several days over the last few 2 months weeding on my knees, you know, for hours on end. And I had no difficulty with knee pain or getting up or down.
Nice.
So, you know, I just don't have a specific focal need for ozone. But I had one client who was, you know, was hard of walking and was looking at knee replacement therapy, who after 3 treatments gave away her cane.
Wow. It helped that much.
And they say it should be 10 treatments.
Wow. That's incredible.
And each treatment is $250. So you're talking a couple of thousand for a course.
Yeah.
You might have to repeat it every 2 to 5 years. But on the whole, it's very well tolerated. And it's close in efficacy to prolotherapy therapy, which is another way to do it. But with prolotherapy therapy, you have pain for days and potentially weeks. Whereas with ozone pain, it's hours and then it's gone.
Yeah. I've heard the prolotherapy before. Is that similar to the PRP or is that different?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Similar thing.
Similar. PRP is just one way to irritate the joint so that repair is encouraged. There are multiple ways of doing it.
Okay.
But it's, they work. They're just not benign. I mean, if you end up having to be in pain for, you know, you have 5 different injections and you're in pain for 3 weeks each injection, that's a pretty high price to pay beyond any money that's involved. But with ozone, all of your discomfort following the injection is over with in the first day.
Wow.
So that makes it a kinder, gentler kind of joint reconstruction that's amazingly effective. Even people who are missing various structures where, you know, a meniscus has torn and there's a big hole in it, it can grow back in and reform.
Wow.
It's, I think, very highly of ozone. And I suspect it's because ozone is, in its ground state, not a radical. You know, oxygen is a free radical, hydrogen peroxide, you know, decomposes into a free radical, superoxide is a free radical. These all have immediate and acute effects as oxidants and antioxidants. Whereas ozone is a stable, it's stable in its ground state as where all the electrons are paired up. It's not a free radical at all. And that allows it to coexist within the body and to flow into tissues. It's a fairly small molecule. It's only slightly bigger than oxygen. So it's able to flow through and get to various target sites very efficiently before it does what it does as an oxidizing agent. And it's a two electron oxidizing agent, non-free radical, rather than a one electron oxidizing agent, which is what makes it something a free radical.
Yeah. So overall, even though you said it's not found in nature, it is pretty safe. It's benign.
Well, it's found in nature. Whenever you have a storm and lightning, you get ozone in the air.
Ozone effect.
So it's environmental, but it's not something that's produced inside the human body.
Okay.
And it actually is dangerous for our lungs.
Is it?
Oh. So you shouldn't be breathing ozone. But the normal way it's given by IV or by anal insufflation or something like that, it keeps it away from your lungs. You can also take a bag, for example, and put it over your arm and seal the ends and put ozone in the bag so it goes through your skin. Yep. And that's okay. You just have to keep it away from your lungs.
Yeah.
So people who do it at home typically will have some kind of a airflow system where they have fresh air being delivered to them so that they're never breathing the ozone that they're making.
Yeah. I forget the guy's name, maybe Ed McCabe or something, Mr. Oxygen. He had a book about that a few years ago, many years back, actually, but he talked all about that. Remember
decades
him?
Decades ago.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very interesting. But I remember the bag thing, and like he talked about it, like clearing out like flus and colds and stuff. You put the bag on and put the ozone like generator.
Yeah, so
on.
if you step into a bag and you seal it around your neck,
yeah,
and you have a fan blowing air through a window right in your face, you can fill the bag up with ozone and treat your whole body and not be at risk. But you have to be very careful when you open up the bag.
Yeah. all right, Steve.
Well, that's one way people sterilize their houses.
That's true.
You seal up your house and turn on your air conditioning or your heating system, turn on an ozone generator, fill your whole house up with ozone. It kills all the bugs and everything like that. Yeah. It also fries your carpeting a bit and damages, paintings and will kill plants. And, if you forget a pet, if you have rats in your wall or in your attic or something like that, it's going to kill them too.
Yep.
So it's a good agent for handling things like black mold inside your walls and stuff like that for people who are hyper allergic to things.
Yep. It's like a mini nuclear bomb, though. It does have some repercussions. Last question I want to ask you today, Steve, is the MARIC approach for COVID has a lot of great things in it. We talked about it personally a few times before. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you would change in that protocol for dealing with COVID? Anything you would update or add to it, and anything that you would take off of it, like you don't like that he has in there?
Yeah, I think that I would add other B vitamins to a lesser extent than the just B1.
Okay.
And I would minimize the corticosteroid.
Really? Why is that? Because
it's immunosuppressive and it interferes with healing.
Okay.
It's anti-inflammatory, but the vitamin C itself is anti-inflammatory sufficiently as long as the dose is high enough. And that's the other thing I would do. I would say instead of 12 grams, twice a day I would have that vitamin C protocol be proportional to the severity of the condition. So he has a flat rate. Everybody gets the same amount of vitamin C. And I would say what you want to do is run your people through a kind of triage process to schedule it. And if you give them 24 grams of vitamin C a day and they're not recovering, you're not seeing that clinical improvement, to bump it to 50 grams a day. And if they're not there, bump it to 100. And if they're not there, bump it to, 150, and just raise the vitamin C level until you see that kind of shift in the clinical response towards recovery.
Yep. Gotcha. And that's about it, though. You wouldn't make any more adjustments. Like, he has a great overall approach, I think. Mm-hmm. Seems pretty effective.
And he came in through at the back. He managed to do it through the back door. I mean, he was looking at vitamin C for sepsis.
Yep.
And that's how he found out about vitamin C, and he tried it and it worked marvelously. Unfortunately, what he didn't realize was that the system is opposed to vitamin C ideologically. It's like, you know, the church being opposed to the theory of the earth not being the center of the solar system or the universe. And so he's run up against a certain amount of pressure on that level. And especially when he switched from sepsis, treating sepsis with it, to treating COVID with it, to some extent, he and his people are being abused by the system.
Yeah, they got to go around it. It's I've been through it myself, man. It's a whole process. There's only certain doctors out there who are actually following the approach, even though I'm sure a lot of them, if you looked at the research, would appreciate how effective it really is.
Yeah, and vitamin C in the doses that he's giving at 12 or 24 grams a day are certainly reachable fairly easily with oral vitamin C. Yeah. So, you know, why go to the trouble of doing intravenous vitamin C twice a day when you can just take 1 gram of vitamin C every hour on the hour?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Here's actually one final thing that I thought of. I meant to ask you earlier, but the I know there's a million things. That PCR test, when you had COVID already and you say you test positive for it later on, like months down the road, is it still saying that you have active COVID in your system, or is it like little remnants of COVID that are still hanging around that aren't?
Oh, really, it could be both.
It could be either.
Remember when I said that, you know, for every one virus that's intact, you've got 10 viruses that are in pieces.
Yep.
Those pieces can hang out in the body. This is also possible for the vaccines. You've got these mRNA containing, you know, lipid particles. They can deposit in various tissues and all, and possibly be stable in some part of the body somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly know that herpes viruses and CMV viruses and Epstein-Barr viruses, they tend to be chronic. And even when you don't have a positive PCR test, at any point in the future, if you get stressed out or something, you can become positive because the viruses are lurking somewhere and they wake up in response to, you know, a divorce, a death in the family, something like that. That's, you know, an IRS audit, whatever it is. Yeah. They wake up and they start multiplying. And then all of a sudden you become PCR positive again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible that COVID could do that.
Yeah. Is it impossible to get, is that the reason why it's impossible, say, to get like Epstein or herpes out of your system for good, like 100% out of your system? You'll never get rid of it no matter, you know, what you're doing antivirally.
Right. You can't get rid of it.
It just hides so well.
When people die and they do surveys, they find 6 copies of herpes for every single cell in your body. That's the kind of ratio. So that means you have trillions of herpes viruses in your system. And so the question is, you know, how many SARS-CoV-2 viruses could you have in your system and not detect them? And the answer is it could be billions. As long as they're not circulating in your bloodstream, they wouldn't show up on a PCR test.
But that also does mean they're not really causing you harm per se, right? Yeah.
At that moment in time, yes.
Okay.
Now, there is a threshold under which a virus can be active enough and still be undetectable.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not likely to be life-threatening. You know, it's like some low-level chronic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not unusual for people with herpes.
Okay.
99% of humans have herpes and only 5 to 10% have flare-ups. So, you know, most of us, we just coexist with the virus. And that's what our innate immune system does for us.
Yep. Awesome. Steve, thanks so much, man, for coming back on the show. I really appreciate it. I picked your brain on so many different topics and, you know, I just learned a ton like I always do. What's a last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave the audience, and then a place our listeners can check out your work?
Well, the main audience is that, you know, people hopefully can realize the degree to which they're being manipulated, that the messages that you're getting through the media and the messages that are being censored on YouTube and Facebook, that's not part of what would be the characteristics of a free society.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that it's wise to recognize the adage, you know, how do you know they're lying? And the answer is their lips are moving. and to, just to recognize to what extent that that's an issue. And not that all the people lying are intentionally lying, because they're not. You know, probably 9 out of 10 people are not intentionally lying. They're lying from a point of ignorance. And that may not be true. It's probably not true of most people who are spokespeople, you know, who their job is to relay information. They pretty much know they're lying all the time and manipulating the truth and saying things in certain ways. And I think the term is spin doctor. But that, you know, this is largely an exaggerated problem, even though it's a severe issue for the elderly. It's a severe issue for people with pre-existing conditions. It's for the average person, it's comparable to a flu episode, and therefore the entire lockdown policy is totally wrong and it needs to be reversed. And that's what the Great Barrington Declaration is all about. So if you've never seen that, do a search, Great Barrington Declaration. It was a document that was produced by eminent scientists in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And, you know, go ahead, read it up. If you agree with it, sign it.
Okay, cool. And so Great Barrington Declaration, we'll have them look up. And the name of the website again is Project Wellbeing.
Project Wellbeing has the Steve page, which has all my books for free. And CERI.com is an older site that has all the smart drug stuff on it, some of which we talked about. I also blog on Quora. So a lot of the questions and answers that Quora has, I think I probably have at some point, I think, I can't remember how many million viewers on Quora. Wow. So it's a place where I answer questions, and all this stuff that you've been asking about in terms of protocols and stuff like that. And by all means, just get the book, Natural Antiviral Self-Defense. Just download the book for free and read it. It'll walk you through all of the different nutritional elements. There is a 10 item, you know, David Letterman's, you know, top 10 list. And yep. Then there's an executive summary, which is like 2 pages, where it breaks it down into what you do before and what you do during an infection. Okay. And then it goes into chapters on each of these elements that's involved in innate and humoral immunity, and lays out what the practical aspects of them are. And there's 300 plus footnotes, and most of the footnotes are references, and there'll be also some analysis in the footnotes, and there's other parts of it that are just annotations. So sometimes I'll be saying something and there'll be an important detail that I'll add in a footnote that isn't important for people who aren't practitioners to know.
Okay. Gotcha. Awesome, man. I'm going to have my guys check that out. I'll link up all this stuff in the show notes as well. Make sure they can just click on it. But Steve, thanks again, man, for coming on. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for the invite. We should do it again.
Absolutely, man. Have you on for a third time or for fourth maybe, but yeah.
By all means.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Take it easy.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I'd like you to do, and that's this. Subscribe to our podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast episodes and all of our world-class advice absolutely free. Subscribe now if you haven't already and become an Elite Man today. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an amazing review. We really do appreciate it.